This is 40A&M N5, a weekly download of 40A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. Nobel Prizes in physics, medicine, and other fields are awarded. U.S. Labor Department issues new jobs numbers, while the EU and U.S. complete a seventh round of talks toward a transatlantic trade and investment partnership. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40A&M N5, the weekly download of 40A&M LLC. It's Tuesday, October 14th, and I'm Chris Bone. First up, two of the Nobel Prizes awarded within the past week were for physics and for physiology or medicine, respectively. The Physics Prize was awarded to Professors Isamu Akasaki, Hiroshi Amano, and Shuji Nakamura for their creation in the early 1990s of the first blue LEDs. The winners will share a prize worth 8 million kroner, or just over $1 million. Although red and green LEDs had been around for many years prior to the trio's work, blue had long eluded researchers, but proved incredibly disappointing as you need blue to mix with red and green in order to produce white light from LEDs for efficient energy lamps or computer screens and for other purposes. Unlike incandescent bulbs, and to a lesser extent fluorescent bulbs, LED-emitted light comes from current applied to semiconductor materials and doesn't generate wasteful heat in the light-emitting process. According to the BBC's Jonathan Webb, the Nobel Committee emphasized the usefulness of the invention in making their decision, noting that Nobel Prizes were established to recognize developments that delivered the greatest benefit to mankind. Professor John O'Keefe, along with colleagues Maybrit Moser and Edvard Moser, will share the award for physiology or medicine for their work in discovering how the brain knows where we are and navigates for us, what has been called the brain's GPS system. Professor O'Keefe discovered that a certain type of cells within a portion of the brain became activated whenever a rat was in a certain place in a room, and other cells activated for other places. The cells located in the brain's hippocampus were dubbed place cells for their function in helping to form a map for us within brain function. The spouse team of Maybrit and Edvard Moser discovered a different part of the brain that acts more like a chart. These cells were later dubbed grid cells, helping the brain to judge distance and navigate. According to the BBC's Jonathan Webb, the Nobel Committee felt that the combination of grid and place cells constituted the comprehensive positioning system, the inner GPS, if you will, of our brain, and added that the system is affected in several brain disorders, including dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Just as the U.S. Labor Department released strong new numbers on the U.S. economy, teams from the U.S. and EU completed a seventh formal round of negotiations toward a transatlantic trade and investment partnership, the proposed comprehensive U.S.-EU trade agreement that has been in development and discussions for about 2 years now. The latest round took place in suburban Washington, D.C. in Chevy Chase, Maryland. U.S. Chief Negotiator Dan Mullaney of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative and Ignacio Garcia Bercero, Chief European Negotiator, ended the sessions with a closing press conference at which neither would give a timetable for when the negotiations might complete. One of the more controversial components of the proposed agreement concerns allowing foreign investors to go to an international tribunal for compensation if one government or the other breaks trade rules in a way that harms the company interests. However, it was not a surprise that EU officials commented that this provision was not a component of the present round, as the EU recently completed a public consultation on the concept and is analyzing the comments received. Meanwhile, as I alluded to at the top of this story, the U.S. Labor Department released numbers showing that the U.S. unemployment rate dipped to 5.9% in September, which would be a six-year low, the lowest recorded since July of 2008. The new numbers show that employers in the U.S. added 248,000 jobs last month, and the Labor Department also revised upwards the numbers that it released for July and August, adding 69,000 more jobs created. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen commented in her public remarks following last week's Federal Open Market Committee meeting that there is only so much slack in the economy if the employment rate falls below 6%. The Fed is due to end its quantitative easing, bond-buying stimulus program later this month, begun in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. But the Fed chair has rebuffed more detail on when the Fed might decide to raise interest rates. In more recent statements, Fed Chair Janet Yellen has commented on her concern that the jobless rate has tended to be problematic as a barometer of job market health, in part because its numbers do not reflect those who might have dropped off the jobless rolls but remain unemployed. The Dow Jones Industrials Average gained over 100 points on the day of the numbers release. Nearly at the same time that the U.S. Labor Department released its most recent batch of numbers, the Paris-based OECD released two new comprehensive studies using both current and historical data to give us a glimpse of how life, globally, has improved as economies have developed. The first of these is the OECD's Regional Outlook 2014, and according to this research, half of the 34 OECD member countries have seen the income gap between their best-off and worst-off regions widened since the 2008 economic crisis. In 10 of the OECD countries, over 40% of the national rise in unemployment since the crisis has in fact concentrated in a single region of the country. OECD Secretary General Angel Gurria, in releasing the report at the 12th European Week of Regions and Cities in Brussels, underscored that smarter public investment, especially in cities, and reforms of outdated local government structures could help to address many issues. The Secretary General's remarks pair up well with the recommendations made this past week in a new McKinsey & Company study on the global offline population, which indicated that of the 7 billion people alive today, more than half are offline. The study data shows that roughly 20 large countries, including India, China, and the U.S., account for roughly 4.4 billion connected global citizens. But even in China, more than half of its 1.3 billion people are offline. Similarly, in India, approximately 1 billion people remain offline. Of those offline in the U.S., a recent Pew study revealed that most choose to be, indicating that they don't see the internet as relevant to their daily lives, whereas only 7% of those offline in the U.S. cite the lack of internet access as a culprit. A second OECD report issued in the past week, entitled How Is Life? Global Well-Being Since 1820, indicated that although inflation-adjusted wages for manual workers have increased eightfold globally since 1820, GDP per capita has risen 10 times over the same period, with the rises greatest in Western Europe, North America, Australia, the Middle East, and North Africa. By contrast, literacy increased dramatically from 20% of the world's population in 1820 to a high of nearly 80% by the year 2000. The study also showed that the reduction of gender inequality has progressed steadily over the past 60 years, but that differences between regions remain large. Western Europe and North America performed best on these measures in the OECD study, while the Middle East, North Africa, South and Southeast Asia are needing the greatest work. A brewing controversy in the UK has called into question the degree to which the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, or RIPA, can or should be used to surveil journalists. According to The Guardian, The Sun had made an official complaint regarding the Metropolitan Police's order of Vodafone for access to Sun political editor Tom Newton-Dunn's phone records. Under RIPA, an officer needs only a senior officer to sign off on an order, but normally, the police would have to apply to a judge for an order under different legislation. This is apparently not the first time in recent months that the RIPA has been cited for its possible use in the context of accessing journalist records. And in reaction, according to The Guardian, the chairman of the UK Parliament's Select Committee has said that he would be asking each UK police jurisdiction to provide detail on how or if RIPA has been used to surveil journalists. The controversy comes as Keith Bristow, Director General of the UK's National Crime Agency, the corollary to the US's FBI, said recently that UK surveillance powers are too weak, but that in order to advance needed surveillance capacity, it will be necessary to win public consent for new powers. UK Home Secretary Theresa May has backed the introduction of greater mass surveillance powers for UK law enforcement. The Communications Data Bill containing these powers has for some time been blocked by the Liberal Democrats over civil liberties concerns. A similar bill in Australia, the National Security Bill, is presently before its parliament, according to CNET's Claire Riley. While emphasizing the need for investigative powers, but conceding that the environment for public trust and their use is far from advantageous, Mr. Bristow said that it would be wrong to grant greater powers to access email and call data without public agreement. The Snowden revelations have damaged public confidence in our abilities, whether it's law enforcement or the intelligence agencies, he said, to access and use data in an appropriate and proportionate way. Several news outlets were reporting last week on a civil case in Albany, New York. The suit, which had been filed some time ago, was originally highlighted by BuzzFeed, then picked up by Naked Security, the online journal of Sophos.com, and also by ABC News and then the Huffington Post. The case involves Asandra Aquiet of Albany, who had previously pleaded guilty in February 2011 to one count of conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cocaine base, admitting, as reported by ABC News, that she had been part of a group that had sold crack cocaine in upstate New York. But it's what happened next that seems to have caught people's attention in the past week. Ms. Aquiet claims that an agent of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency then used information from her smartphone to construct a phony Facebook account, one that was then used in an attempt to lure other potential suspects. In the court filing, the agent's lawyer argued that by handing over access to her mobile phone and all of its data to federal agents upon her arrest, she implicitly consented to use of her data, pictures, and contacts and the creation of the fake Facebook account in her name, under the rubric of aiding in ongoing criminal investigations. According to reporting by both ABC News and BuzzFeed, the fake Facebook account in her name not only used pictures from her phone showing her dressed only in underwear, but also posed close-up photos of her niece and nephew, and that the agent accepted friend requests on her behalf and solicited friending with a known fugitive. According to the Huffington Post, she even appeared to write that she had missed her boyfriend, who was identified by his nickname. Ms. Aquiet wasn't told of the fake account by officials, according to reporting, but learned of it on her own in 2010, which precipitated the suit. As of Monday last week, the Facebook profile was still visible, but according to the Huffington Post, it has since been taken down by Facebook because the fake profile violates Facebook's community standards. Ms. Aquiet's suit against the Justice Department seeks between $250,000 and $500,000, claiming fear and great emotional distress due to the danger of her publicly appearing to be willfully cooperating in further investigations. The case was scheduled to go to trial next week, but according to ABC News, it has been instead referred to mediation. In court documents, the department is claiming that by consenting to the search of her mobile phone, the plaintiff had relinquished any expectation of privacy that she may had to the photographs it contained. Justice Department spokesman Brian Fallon said in a statement on Tuesday, reported by the Huffington Post, that officials were reviewing both the incident and the practice, as he declined to comment further as the case was still pending. The notion that voluntarily giving up access to your mobile phone to authorities opens up limitless possibilities for use of that data by law enforcement is the most concerning element highlighted by this case in the past week. University of Pennsylvania Law School professor Anita Allen was quoted in the Sophos Security article on the case, noting that if you consent to a search of your home, that does not mean that your photos can be taken from the coffee table and then posted online or be used to usurp your identity. Netflix, which has helped to shake up age-old, time-tested distribution models for entertainment content, with its hit series House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, announced another surprise this past week. Netflix announced that it's inked a deal to be an exclusive home for four new movies to star and be produced by Adam Sandler. According to National Public Radio, Variety, and others discussing the October 2nd announcement, don't expect the movie fare to be made to parallel Adam Sandler's critically acclaimed forays into heady drama, films such as Punch Drunk Love, Funny People, and Rain Over Me. Instead, the expectation is that the films will play up Sandler's comedic chops, honed in films like Happy Gilmore, Big Daddy, and The Wedding Singer. As NPR's Linda Holmes said, the more ways to consume content there are, the more business models there are. The more you see uncertainty about what works best lead to structural experimentation. Experimentation used to mean a movie star tries television. Now it may mean deals like this one Adam Sandler has made with Netflix. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 40 A&M in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from CNET, The Guardian, the BBC, Slate, BuzzFeed, ABC News, National Public Radio, and The Huffington Post. Thank you for listening. 40 AM and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, October 20th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.